Conversations like this are tailored for podcast listeners like you. Learn how you can support them at radioopensource.org. And thanks for being in on it. Paul Theroux, independent writer, prolific writer, friend of mine for half a hundred years, half a hundred books. Where are we today?
I sometimes wonder where we are, even how we got here. But when I was growing up in Boston, in Medford, and coming to Boston a lot, there were a lot of books that were forbidden. I grew up at a time when, and you did too, when books were banned, writers were outlaws, and writing was a profession of half crime, half magic, and it made me want to be a writer. And it made me also want to leave home, because there was something forbidden about books then. The major difference between then and now is how writers are so accessible. Go to your local bookstore, if you've got a local bookstore, and you'll find your writer. Norman Mailer, before he died, was showing up at bookstores giving talks and so forth. But in the 1940s and 50s, he was an invisible presence. Styron was invisible. James Jones was invisible. They weren't there. So the world of writing has really changed. I wanted to become a writer because it was a forbidden, powerful profession that allowed you to travel and allowed you to become invisible and mysterious. Mm. Now, you know, everyone and his brother's publishing books, you know, self-publishing. Or
I'm fascinated, Paul, by the era itself. 50 years. You've been everywhere. Patagonia, the Congo. You discovered some of them. At a period, though, from JFK's Peace Corps, in which you served, to ISIS and Donald Trump's wall between us and Mexico. I have this notion that we don't understand anything till 40 or 50 years later, but what do you come to see as the definition of this time?
I joined the Peace Corps at a time when there were colonies in Africa, Portuguese colonies, French colonies, Spanish colonies, British colonies, I mean, or territories, Rhodesia, Mozambique, Angola, the Congo. Most of them had not become independent republics. The big difference in the post-colonial world is people fighting for their freedom, winning their freedom. Congo, Mozambique, Angola, Rhodesia, you know, became Zambia, Kenya, and whatnot. Eritrea broke away from Ethiopia. They became independent, proud countries with a flag and a president. And then the president just stayed in power and wouldn't go away. I was in Nyasaland in 1963. Nyasaland was a British territory. Mm. And the president, Dr. Hastings Banda, stayed there for 34 years. Mugabe's been in power for 35 years. Dos Santos has been in Angola for 35 years. So they want to leave. Mm. When I went to Africa, in fact, the world as it was constituted 50 years ago was a world in which people talked about five-year plans and wanting to stay in the country and build a country. Now, if you go to any country in the world, and that includes China, India, successful countries, Brazil, pretty successful, Russia, you know, independent and successful, what will they say? Go to any classroom and say, what do you want to do when you leave here? And they'll say, I want to go to America. I want to leave this country. I want to leave this. They won't say hellhole, but hellhole is in the back of their mind. They want to go to Britain, Western Europe, or America. That was not a factor. I never even heard that. All I heard was, I want to get an education, sir, when I was there, or, you know, Buana. And because I ran a school from 63 to 65, and then I was teaching in Uganda up to 68, then I was in Singapore up into 71, 72. So for 10 years, I was in education in Africa and Southeast Asia. I never heard people say, I'm leaving this country, I want to leave. I always heard them say, I'm going to stay. So the big thing is, whatever nationalism was then has disappeared. I was a witness to the colonial period, the Gymkhana Club that wouldn't accept Africans. It was a kind of sports club in Kenya and Uganda and Malawi. They got their first Indians while I was there. Then the independence, they integrated the club. And then built roads and whatnot and schools, got a government, got a dictator, and then people wanted to go. So from colonial to post-colonial to independence to mass desire for emigration.
Mm. What about the face of us, the face of you, American? You were an exotic in the early 60s coming through Africa. Today, in the jet age, American bankers, American tourists, American students, American teachers are everywhere. How do people look at you differently the American off the plane or off the bus.
In other countries?
Yeah.
They see an older white guy that they could tease, rob. I mean, I was in Africa in 2003, and a guy in Malawi said to me, "Mzungu, wewe kwenda wapi?" I said, "Why are you calling me Mzungu?" You know, it means white man. I said, "Do you want me to call you black man?" I said, "I got a name. Do you have a name?" "Dina Landani, Simon." I said, "Okay, my name's Paul. You can call me Paul. Don't call me white man, okay?" No one would have done that. So what do they think? They see, it's a fogeyish thing to say, but they're much ruder. I rode through the bush on a motorcycle. It was a priest's motorcycle in the middle of Diasaland in 63, 64, and people fell to their knees. Thinking that I was a priest, they fell to their knees and praying. And they were very, very pious, obsequious. Now, older people are somewhat invisible. But, I mean, I think, or very invisible. That's an advantage in traveling.
Come back to the whole era, Paul. If you and I, same age practically, had been born 100 years earlier, we would have come of age to see the beginning of the Civil War. We would have lived into World War I. And we would have met, among other things, you know, in our trades, Lincoln and Henry James and Mark Twain and maybe Alexander Graham Bell, even here in Boston. But it's an incredibly long space we've lived through, even in our century, from Second World War to God knows where we're at.
The transformation.
The 50 years, a whole lot happens in 50 years. Yeah. When you think of the Mark Twains and Lincolns and Frederick Douglass's and all sorts of Emily Dickinson's, other people over that 50-year period, who do you clasp to your breast among the people you've met? I mean, thinking...
Of the writers I've met?
Or... artists, statesmen, forgotten but should be remembered stars of our era.
I've met a lot of politicians, but I don't regard any of them. They all seem like hollow men to me. Clinton, for example, very amiable, very charismatic, highly intelligent, a hollow man, an atoner, a strange man. Probably the people who seek power are very strange. Actually, there's a very good book on this subject by Elias Canetti, Crowds and Power, about seeking power and how you get power. So powerful people, I've been kind of amused by. The idea that someone wants to control other people is very, it's amusing.
Mm.
Even people campaigning for 2 years to be president, it's weird seeing them. It's the tallest dwarf competition. You think, let's choose the tallest dwarf. Writers, I've known a lot of writers and I've sought them out. Very early in my life, in my college years, I saw Robert Frost walking down the street in 1962 in Amherst. And I stopped him and I said, "Mr. Frost," he said, "what do you want?" Very rude. I said, "will you sign a book for me?" He said, I sign books and I sell them for a lot of money. Why should I do it for you?" I said, "because, well, I don't have any money." So I had a book called In the Clearing with me. And I said, "will you sign it?" "Oh, all right." So he signed it. Then we had a talk and he said, "you might be related to Henry David Thoreau." I said, "maybe by Adam or Noah, but I don't think anyone else." Then he kind of settled down. He was in his 80s then with only a few years to go. And I thought, I'm meeting a man who was born in the 19th century, who knew Edward Thomas, Ezra Pound, even when he was there, gray hair. Mm. He had quite a lot of gray hair. Grumpy, gray, but I felt I had a link. I looked for writers. I wanted to meet writers. Mm. What do they talk about? How do they look? What's their career like? And so later in Africa, I met some but not many. Nadine Gordimer I met there. Once in Singapore, Anthony Burgess came by. He was probably in his 50s then, maybe early 50s. It was 68 or 69. Came through, we were talking in general. I remember he wrote a book called Time for a Tiger. I said, "do you want a beer?" He said, I don't drink beer anymore. But I felt writers were magical then and now. I think of writers as magical figures.
You met the great Naguib Mahfouz in Cairo. Also, Graham Greene was a friend of yours, no?
I knew Graham Greene fairly well, yeah. Mysterious, kind of secretive guy, but very helpful to me, and he wrote letters, and I still have his letters. Naguib Mahfouz was he had been shot when I met him in Egypt. He had a bullet wound in his shoulder, neck. V.S. Pritchett, I still think, is a very underrated writer. Pritchett, as an essayist, reviewer, and short story writer, one of the great short story writers. There's a writer called John Collier. I knew his widow. I wrote an introduction to his book called His Monkey Wife.
Hmm.
It's about a man who marries a chimpanzee accidentally. It's a satire on the flappers and feminism of the 1920s. John Collier wrote the script to The African Queen and wrote a number of short stories and books. He's not known now. You mentioned his name. No one will know who John Collier is. It's a strange thing that a lot of writers that I admire a lot are unknown. Ford Madox Ford, Elizabeth Taylor, the short story writer. No one knows her.
You know, it sticks in my mind after somebody like Stanley Hoffman, venerable international scholar, said to me not long before he died, you know, the writers of my whole era, he was French-born, are Camus and Orwell. They got it for his century. Who do you think of that way?
I don't think of Camus that way, funnily enough. I've reread Camus. I think Camus is very deficient. I think that George Simenon, who wrote about 400 books, is far more interesting and wrote about the same thing. He also wrote about the acte gratuit, and he wrote maybe four books like L'Étranger at the same time as Camus, and was very annoyed that he didn't get the Nobel Prize. You know who I mean by Simenon? Yeah, so I reread The Plague, Camus. It's set in Algeria. It has all French characters, no Arabs, and no women in it. That's a book. You know, you're saying, what's your problem? So Camus doesn't do it for me. Orwell does. In my time, I would say someone like Noam Chomsky, although Chomsky is no great stylist, but he's someone who he has a backbone of iron, and he knows his mind, and if people listened to him, it would be a better world. He's not Orwell, though. Orwell had a sense of humor and was a good novelist. I mean, in some books, great novelist. I think Burmese Days is a great novel. 1984 is a great novel. Chomsky never did that. Yours is a hard question. I don't read a lot of contemporary.
I'm making a list for myself and for our listeners.
Of writers who were influential or writers?
No. Treasures that we haven't opened yet.
Let me think. I would say William Trevor, although is not American.
Irish short stories.
Short story writer and novelist. People talk about him a little bit, but he's really great. I mean, as a short story writer, fabulous short story writer, and he's pretty much undiscovered. But I know him. He lives in the depths of the English countryside and writes every day, and no one pays that much attention to him. I used to think Gore Vidal had it, but there was a vanity to the band that was a little unbearable, and a sort of flash that someone like Orwell didn't have. I find the question really hard, because I avoid reading contemporaries because I don't want their voices in my head. Mm-hmm. I was thinking the other day, when Hemingway was writing in the 1950s, Saul Bellow was also writing. Did anyone say to Hemingway, as they sometimes say to me, hey, Hem, read the new Saul Bellow? It's supposed to be really good. Augie Bunch, hey, Hemingway, and Hemingway's fishing or something like that. Hey, how about that Saul Bellow? I think he said, I don't give a shit about him. Who cares? Okay, he's good, but I'm doing my own thing, okay? So when people say to me, so what do you think of, and they mention a name, I say, I don't really know this person. And if I read them, I'd be surrendering part of my day to have this voice in my head solving a problem, perhaps, that I want to solve on my own. So I like Philip Roth. I read Philip Roth. I feel as if he's a different species. He's writing about a different world, the Jewish world. He's slightly older. He doesn't write anymore. But I was a regular reader of his books, and his last short books, Every Man, for example.
I loved that.
It was a great book. And it didn't get a lot of play, but I read him regularly. And he's had his success. We're talking about books. We're like stamp collectors. We're like lepidopterists. Who reads books? Not many people read books.
You didn't mention Nabokov, and I wish you would. Speaking of lepidopterists.
Well, big influence on me, but inimitable. And like Joyce, you read him and you're spoiled for life. You think, I'll never be this man. I'll never write like him. It's intimidating reading a Nabokov. So when people say to me, I want to be a writer, what should I read? I say Simenon. Read a Simenon. It will take you an afternoon to read. You'll see a guy solving a problem in Simenon. You'll never learn a new word reading Simenon, but it's interesting stuff. Nabokov, you read, you know, it's a rich meal. He's someone that can discourage you from ever being a writer. But as a pleasure, yeah, fabulous. But I started to say that not many people read. When I was growing up, as I said, books were forbidden. Now, books are everywhere. You can say anything. You can say any curse word, any word of abuse, you could write about any sexuality, anything goes. And so there's nothing forbidden about books. But actually, people going out and buying a book in a bookstore is a very select few. It's always been a small number, but I think it's an even smaller number now.
All this is preparation for your tour of the American South in this new book. Play out one theme that comes back and back. It reminds you of Africa.
Yeah, very much so. The South is a hollowed out, they say hollowed out and wallowed in the middle. There was something there once. It was a plantation. And then factories set up there. The agriculture is now mechanized. The factories are closed. So what have you got? You have something like the post-colonial world. It's like Zimbabwe in that the farmers have been kicked out of Zimbabwe, so the fields are dead. There's no activity. There's people sitting in the shade drinking, like Africa. Black men drinking beer in the shade. Many of them war veterans. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting thing. Guys have made major contributions, sitting there with no job, living on welfare. And the shopkeepers are all from India. They're from Gujarat.
Fascinating. So, Mr. Patel, Mr. here Patel, and there.
The inevitable Mr. Patel. So the Indian shopkeeper, the unemployed man drinking, children running around, careworn women, women trying to keep the family together, defunded schools, very hot, very dry, very dusty. And you look on the horizon, it's just dust in the air. And you think, where have I seen this before? Yeah, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, the western part of Kenya, the eastern part of Uganda.
It jumps out that in both cases, there's a kind of, the romance with education is gone. The investment in education.
The investment in education. In most places, they've defunded it. You always hear politicians say, we're going to do something about education. And they say, well, we just don't have the money for it. They have money for other things. So, yeah, the faith in it. What I noticed in the South is also what you noticed in a third world country. As a preacher told me, he said, I don't know what's wrong here, but people leave here and they shine. They go to up north and they shine. Why can't they do it here? Why don't they shine here? And people say that in Africa. They say, you know, look at the Nigerian novelist is a feature of the American literary landscape now. Not in Nigeria. The African writer going to England or Australia or coming to the States. Why is that the case? The movements of people in our lifetime. First, the population of the United States has doubled since 1950. More than doubled. It was 150 million in 1950. It's 330 million now. What is the effect of that? It's amazing. The little town in Massachusetts or Maine is now a city or a very, very big town. You can't find a parking space. You go to a town, Lewiston, Maine. There are Somalis in Lewiston, Maine. Very odd. Very odd indeed. Go to even a filling station in Rockland, Maine. Mr. Patel will be there. And you think, what the hell? You know, how did this happen? The disenchantment with the planet has sent people, the great movements of people. How do you become a writer in Africa? Go to America. How do you become prosperous in India? Leave. Go to Mississippi and open a gas station. Your brother was there. Your uncle is there. Your cousin was in Canada and left. So what you notice in the South is how the world is changing and also what the world might look like when it ends. I felt this very, very strongly in South Carolina. Yeah, I felt this is what the world is going to look like when it ends. It will be a great road and a motel, a restaurant, a gas station, all of them closed, rusty pumps, signs falling down. But the road will be okay because there's no traffic on the road. You'll say, gee, there's nobody here. And then you'll notice in the bushes some people. Crouched in the bushes. And I had that very strongly in the South. I still think it's salvageable. Build a school, run a school, have some hope, have some leadership. Who's running it? Nikki Haley, formerly Miss Randhawa. She's a Sikh. Her parents from the Punjab. Bobby Jindal. So you got two Indians running things. I'm not making a racial point. I'm only saying they got here yesterday. Yesterday. But the people to the South, the blacks who built the South, have been there for hundreds of years. Hundreds of years. They're there. Deep, deep roots that people don't want to leave. So I think all you have to do is tap into the human wealth of the South and you've got a country. Give them work. Why do people go to China? You know, they build things in China. You can build things in Alabama, but they don't. Tim Cook, who's from Alabama, is a billionaire because he manufactures things in China. Phil Knight, same thing. $310 sneakers in Vietnam. In Wynn, Arkansas, there's a whole tradition of making shoes. Phil Knight doesn't make them there. He chooses to make them in Ho Chi Minh City. Why? So the South obviously needs investment, they need education, and they need hope. But they got the people.
Your point about immigration rings all sorts of bells in my head under the heading of, you know, we don't understand it till 40, 50 years later. But it's so clear now that you and I and the culture that we grew up in was the fruit of two great migrations. Jews out of Eastern Europe and blacks out of Jim Crow South made jazz, American music, the NBA, the Basie Band, the NFL, everything we see.
And books. And Ralph books Ellison, too. Richard Wright.
Absolutely. But I'm thinking also especially of places where the migrations combine. When I hear John Coltrane playing Richard Rodgers' My Favorite Things, transforming it, or Charlie Parker playing Jerome Kern, I think, you know, that's the house we grew up in.
Yeah.
And I wonder what 40 years later will be the fruit of Bobby Jindal's, Mr. Patel's America. What do you think?
You're touching on a really interesting point, because what makes a country great is memory. It's the memory of how things were. People who just come to a country have only the memory of where they came from. There's no historical memory. The stories that they hear are the stories that they heard from their parents who were leaving their war-torn or poor or miserable place, wherever it was. In the South, people have the stories. The American story is told by people who were born here and who have lived through generations. This is why traveling in the South is such a wonderful, unrepeatable experience, because the South, more than any other place, has a memory of how things were. And this is how you avoid making mistakes, or you avoid sort of repeating the idiocies of the past. Anyone who went through the Vietnam War would have known that Iraq and Afghanistan were a big mistake. They've been through it. Talk to any Vietnam vet. He'll say, never again, don't do it, never again, never. But get new people, migrants who are willing to join the army, or people who weren't in the war, the Dick Cheneys, who say, yeah, we got to fight. When they say we, they mean you or other people. So historical memory can save you from error. By the same token, you get great literature building on the literature of the past. The idea that there are schools that don't teach Huckleberry Finn, for example, that don't know Huckleberry Finn, that don't know even people like Kurt Vonnegut or Henry James, that don't know them, they're just names, or maybe not even names them, that's very, very bad. Very, very bad. So you get a teacher who came, wants a job, came to America, and they say, okay, we'll start. And they're teaching, but they're not building on the past.
The odd news in your book about the South, Paul, is that you don't get the story out of those famous Southern writers. Obviously Faulkner, but Carson McCullers, Flannery O'Connor. You found that they were of another, almost another planet from what you were seeing and experiencing.
Yes, because they're not writing about the present. The great stories that you hear in the South are people's stories about their families, hard times, or sometimes great times, making squirrel smothered gravy or a baked raccoon or whatever it is, or people who live through hard times. They don't know Faulkner. They don't know Flannery O'Connor. But their stories are kind of parallel to them. The people I met in the South were not readers. People didn't have books in their house.
Yeah.
But, you know, kind of immaterial. I would say that the South's literature misrepresents it. And no one writes about the South as it is now. The Walmart on the bypass road, the Piggly Wiggly store, the pawn shop, the gun store. Or the idea that there are Southern towns that have black governments that never had them. They have black mayor, black alderman, black dog catcher, and things haven't changed. So the whites are kind of out of power. The whites are Republicans. Blacks are Democrats. They're in power. But there's no money. So the whites are saying, so now what are you going to do?
Paul Theroux, you're my model of what I call the young old man. And I admire your energy, your production. What's the secret of sustaining your curiosity?
What a Jew would call spilkus, agitation, spilkus. And also, as Chuck Close said memorably, he said, I don't believe in inspiration. I go to work every day. I sit down every morning and work, and I always have. Even when I was in college, I used to sit down and write before I went to class. When I was a teacher in Africa, I sat down and worked in the morning or in the evening, writing every day. I thought it's a joy. I never believe people when they say writing is hard. I would say, you're lucky. You're not a soldier, you're not a fisherman, you're not picking pineapples. It's a wonderful profession. It's a joyous, productive profession. I started out saying it's empowering. I thought writers were outlaws, powerful figures. I now see that they're happy people. Happy, and you've got to stay healthy. But the idea that you do it every day, the law of arts is the law of excess. The more you write, the more you're able to write. Simenon had a writer's block, believe it or not, man who wrote hundreds of books. When he got through his writer's block by writing a book, by actually dictating a book. It's called When I Was Old. It's a great book, actually. I've never, you know, knocking on wood now, I've never had it. But It's not hard to write 50 books if you live a long time.
You say people don't see older men or even hear them or listen, and yet you get through it.
Anonymity, to live unseen, anonymous, and not need attention is really a very liberating thing, to lose your ego that way. I mean, I suppose there's a lot of ego in my writing or creativity, but to be old, just to be, I was traveling in Africa. In Africa, an old person is, an elder is a sort of revered person, mzee, they call him, old man. In Hawaii, it's a kupuna. I'm a kupuna. You're venerable. The more venerable you get, the more invisible you get. And yeah, people stop seeing you. But that's a great thing. I mean, there was a time when I just looked at women and I hoped that they were looking at me. And I was actually always looking at women. And I suppose I still do, but with a different intention, with a pure kind of objectivity, not with any ulterior motive. But I think old age is a gift in that way. You know things that other people don't know. They talk about me as a traveler, and I say to people, beyond retirement age, just 65 or older, I'm 74. You've been places where no one has been. No one has seen what you've seen. You've seen the past. You've been in the past. That's the bourne from which, you know, no traveler can return. You've seen the past. You were there. You were there when the Vietnam War started. You saw, maybe you heard Hiroshima, the invasion of whatever country, the assassination of Kennedy. You saw the trauma, a traumatized country. You were there. And you saw it. And you traveled there. And no one could travel there then. You're a traveler. No one can repeat your travels. So you think you've seen nothing in your little town in Massachusetts, and you're 68 years old, but think of what you've seen. Think of what a witness you've been.
Paul Theroux, it's a huge pleasure to see you and to read you in the South and elsewhere. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
For many more conversations about arts, ideas, and politics, please visit our website, subscribe to our newsletter, and leave us a comment at radioopensource.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Radio Open Source. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project.